Hi, my name is Bruce Bulgin. I'm founder of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance. We're a 14-year-old organization dedicated to outreach and learning in the concept of stakeholder management and disclosures. And today, our discussion is around the role of unions and stakeholder capitalism. And we're lucky to have two people who are experts in the area of unions, starting first with Tom. It's actually Tom Anton Kokin. He's and am I pronouncing that right? Is it Kokin? I'm sorry, Tom. I forgot
that. That's pretty good. Kochen is a little tighter, but that's all
Kochen
right.
Is your name?
Kochen.
Okay.
It's
thank
an
you,
old
sir.
German name.
And he is George Maverick Bunker, Professor of Management, Professor Emeritus at MIT, Management, the Sloan School of Management. And we have Larry Bieferman, whose name I do know how to pronounce. He's independent consultant and fellow at the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy. And he recently just joined us on a show on Worker Voice. Just a quick little plug for our sponsors who are, I shouldn't even say they're sponsors, they're the organizations that we do business with. And through the learning and work that we do with them, we share that learning with you. And finally, we give away a ton of free information. We're stakeholder capitalists. Go to our websites and you'll find that we literally give away our IP in many respects to help companies implement what we believe is really the total quality management of people in business. Okay, we're done with the advertisements now. Thank you again, gentlemen, for joining us. And Tom, you've made a career, it seems, of studying labor relations in the United States. What is the state of union management trust today, as you, based on the decades of experience you have?
Well, first, Bruce, thank you for hosting this webinar. And Larry, it's great to work together with you on this. I would say that the state of trust is in flux at the moment. And that's good news, because I think it's been as low as it's possibly able to go in the U.S. In the last decade. And it really started in the change in the 1980s with the Great Recession of the 1980s. Then the move, as you well know, from a sense that we should have a stakeholder capitalism approach to managing enterprises to this high emphasis on maximizing shareholder value. And that put in place two decades of very strong managerial opposition to unions, union decline, closing down existing operations that were unionized, opening up new ones in many manufacturing industries, and the restructuring led to a real low level of trust. We saw many labor management partnerships, which are highly effective, fall apart because of these developments. But now the good news is the enormous increase in worker interest in organizing, in gaining a stronger voice at work. The more activism that's going on out there is leading to a bit of a reassessment again on the part of some business executives. And I think that's starting to move us in a positive direction that I hope we can help sustain.
So then, and Larry, I'm going to ask you to elaborate on this. What Tom seems to be saying is that this new receptivity to the value of workers as an asset rather than as a sunk cost to be minimized might be creating a better respect on the management side for the potential value that unions could create. Am I being is that an optimistic translation of what Tom has said?
Well, maybe I might rephrase it. A greater appreciation for their workers and what they contribute to the success of the enterprise, and let's say one way or another to connect or engage with them in ways calculated to improve company performance. How that gets translated is a somewhat different story.
Well, that we'll talk about it in a minute.
That's the issue.
So, well, this leads to kind of the next question. We've noticed that people that traditionally have been somewhat, sensitive to worker value, like Howard Schultz at Starbucks, has seemed to have taken a pretty virulent approach against unions. But let's go to the positive side, Tom. Assuming that unions can play a role assuming that there can be a and we're going to talk about those worker management committees in a few minutes, but what kinds of ways can unions actually add value to corporations if we're going to really think positively?
We have a lot of evidence that it's the quality of the union management relationship that really matters in terms of whether it's positive or negative effects on productivity and on the success of the enterprise and on the quality of the products and services produced. We've studied this in the airline industry, in the healthcare industry, in manufacturing, in the clothing industry, in a variety of others. And we find that that unions per se have a wide variety of effects on outcomes. And if it's a traditional adversarial relationship, those outcomes for the companies, from the company standpoint, tend to be negative. But if it's a joint positive relationship where the union is accepted as a partner working with management and the union leaders develop the capacity to work with management, then you get higher levels of productivity than you would in a non-union standard operation or in a standard union operation. And what that means is the union is accepted and not fought every time an organizing drive comes along. Secondly, when you negotiate, you use problem-solving techniques called interest-based, other tools of modern negotiation to look at root causes of issues that you want to address. And then third, there's an ongoing partnership in the sense that you involve employees right on the front lines in problem-solving and continuous improvement in projects that bring in new technologies or that address changes in product mix and so on. But there's involvement from the workplace right up to the corporate level, where labor leaders and employers will meet periodically to address issues or maybe even have someone sit on the board of directors.
So isn't it then, Larry, it really gets down to trust, I would imagine, that you cannot have this type of relationship between labor and management without trust that there is an interest in fulfilling the purpose of the organization. What is that state of trust is not easy to get to in a corporation in the current environment, is it, Larry? How much trust is there between, generally speaking, management and labor? And Tom seems to give us a little hope that there might be a chance for getting back, and we'll get back to that time when labor and management work more together. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, again, I think that go back and rephrase the question.
Well, my question is trust. To create the conditions that Tom has talked about, it seems to me the fundamental, we have to have trust between labor and management. And that seems to me to be the hardest thing to get to.
Let's say likely a necessary, if not sufficient condition. The practical question is, how do you generate that trust?
Right.
Okay. And it seems to me you've got to have, if you will, an infrastructure of institutions and practices that enable and facilitate it and afford an opportunity for the parties to seize the opportunities which those institutions and processes create. And in a way, unions potentially are institutions which can help foster trust. For example, and maybe Tom can comment on this, and we talked about this a little bit in the work of Voice Beat. If you want workers to contribute in a variety of ways, right? And part of that is to the success of the enterprise, and part of that is speaking out and up about how the company operates in a variety of ways, as well as how it affects them specifically. They have to have the confidence to speak up, that it will be positively received, that they will get some benefit for it, et cetera, et cetera. Under the right circumstances, unions provide that institution which affords them the security and protection to enable them to speak out and speak up in an individual as well as on a collective basis, as an example.
Tom, that issue of trust, I would imagine that's really critical. So there's one way that we can build trust. How do we build trust between unions? You've seen it. when unions, you've said to us that when unions and management work together, you can actually be more productive. You can have higher quality. And again, that harkens back to my notion of total quality management for people. How do you build trust in an era of many CEOs who have a distrust of unions and many unions that have a distrust of management?
Trust is earned, and it has to be demonstrated that there can be a positive relationship between the union and the company. And you start on small projects sometimes. You start in small ways, and you build personal relationships between the leaders of the company and the leaders of the union. And you try to develop some common vision for where you want to go and what's needed in the business to be successful and what changes are coming down the road that are going to require some adaptation and some innovation. We have worked on a model for starting with first contracts, or even starting when the organizing process occurs, that says you can't bring in a bunch of anti-union consultants to fight the union to the death. That really is a hurdle that is almost impossible to overcome in the short run. But if you respect workers' rights and you, as an executive, you listen to what workers are saying and don't take the egotistical approach that Howard Schultz has taken that says, I know what's good for you as workers, and I'm a good employer, and I take care of you, and we don't need this, quote, third party. That is fighting the labor wars of the past. That's rhetoric that has no meaning to workers. It creates distrust. And instead, if you at the beginning say, all right, here's reasons I think you don't need to organize, and make your case respectfully, but I'll respect whatever the vote happens to be or whatever the process produces. And then if a union does get organized, then sit down and say, let's create some rules of the game for how we're going to negotiate a first contract. How are we going to approach it? What issues are most important to you? What issues are important to us? Are we going to use training to develop problem solving and interest-based approaches to negotiation, or are we going to do it in a more traditional way? But really set the stage in those first negotiations to say, we want to get a first contract that's fair, that respects your needs and our needs. And then we start to put in place processes for participation on an ongoing basis and communication on an ongoing basis, because you never get the first contract in place without some bugs in it and some things you didn't anticipate. And maybe the clause that you wrote doesn't quite work the way you think it should work. So you have to have ongoing conversations. And it's those ongoing conversations that demonstrate one's commitment to building trust and to making progress together. And then, because there are always bumps in the road, there's some managers in your organization that don't buy into this. There may be some union leaders who don't buy into this. Then you have to have a process for working through those bumpy moments and recognizing that, if we stay committed to this, we'll solve those problems. We'll deal with those issues. We may have to sometimes move some people around to make sure that we demonstrate our commitment. Those are the small steps. But they're crucial steps. The key is that the top leaders of the CEO, the top operating officers, the HR people, or the share a commitment to making this relationship work. And there always are internal differences in management on this, and they have to be negotiated out as well. And there has to be firm leadership at the top to say, I'm not going to put up with old attitudes toward unions. We're going to develop a relationship that works.
And this would seem to me that the big opportunity, and this gets to your area of worker voice, is for management, even union leaders, to focus on their role in value creation, And in other words, to me, it seems the big opportunity is to not just negotiate with unions over costs, you know, and contracts, but to involve unions in the actual success of the organization. In other words, view unions as a partner. And if we establish the organization's purpose, like Nike or Patagonia have a very clear purpose, and if we establish it, yes, it's part of our goal to make XYZ profits per year, instead of fighting the union, Larry, isn't it possible to have to, especially for a company that's already unionized, right? Wouldn't it make sense to, and are there examples of companies, and I think there are, that view the union as a partner and enable the workers to share in the success of collaboration? Is that a model for the future, engaging the union in the success of, and, or bringing back, as Tom said, what existed in the past, engaging, making part unions partners in the success of the organization and getting rid of this adversarial approach? Is that a fantasy, Larry?
No, I mean, again, the question is what and Tom's alluding to sort of so the practical steps to doing so. And again, I think, as he was suggesting, in a way, you need leadership on both sides, right? So willing to take the initiative and in a way, take the risk. On the management side, my impression, Tom can comment better than me, the anti-union ideology, even with unions, is very, very strong. And you've got to have a leader who has a sense to look beyond that rhetoric or that ideology, recognize the opportunities which for collaboration, which Tom has described, and define a path on the company side. On the union side, I think in part probably as a result of the fierce fights over unionization and over particular contracts, whatever, sometimes boxes leaders in terms of their rhetoric and their positioning on issues. It makes them reluctant, maybe in certain ways, to fear being too collaborative with a company. And the question is, having leadership is willing to, again, come up with ideas and be bold enough and resourceful enough to push them forward. That's tricky.
Yeah, let me put this in a little bit of perspective as well, a historical perspective. We had a lot more of these labor management partnerships starting in the 70s, but really building in the early 1980s. And then many of them dissipated. And as unions got weaker and weaker, fewer and fewer executives had experience with managing in a unionized environment. And so now we've got a very, very weak bench strength, I would call it, within management. And the companies recognize it themselves. We don't have enough people with experience on how to manage and lead in an organized workforce. And in fact, a colleague of mine and I wrote a Harvard Business Review paper that'll be out later this month that basically says managing an organized workforce may be the most important skill for management to learn in the next decade, because not enough people have those skills. There's no magic to it, but it does require a different leadership strategy and approach. And we've got to deepen the bench strength within organizations so that we can make this work.
Well, we'll be sure to publicize that article when it comes out, Tom. So let me ask, tell us a little bit about worker management committees, and maybe even give us a sense of what that shining tower on the hill, as Reagan said, or whatever, what that would look like, an ideal management labor collaboration.
Well, it has to start and be grounded with workers on the front lines contributing ideas for continuous improvement. I'll give you an example. Out at Kaiser Permanente, an organization that has a labor management partnership, now it's had some rocky times and it's going through some challenges right now. But by and large, the foundation of that partnership is right there in what they call unit-based teams. That is teams of nurses, docs, technical specialists, and service employees who deliver the food and clean the rooms and so on, who meet to talk about how to do one of four things: improve cost control, improve service quality, improve patient experience in terms of attitudes and improve Kaiser as a place to work. And they take that as their compass for how they focus their energies on monthly meetings to discuss ideas. And then to follow up, there's a very good, well-developed training process for how you conduct those meetings, how you follow up on them, how you hold people accountable. And they have improved quality. They have improved patient outcomes. They have improved safety and health for the workforce. And it starts there. Then you have
to be clear. This is the union managing this process. You're telling
it's the union. Then you manage it jointly. You manage it jointly. It can't just be the union managing it. So there is a council that consists of some union representatives in the region, and Kaiser executives or managers and some physicians who oversee these. And they keep track of them and they evaluate them and so on. And then at the top of Kaiser Permanente, there's another council that oversees all of the partnership activities, including what happens right there down on the ground level. They have about 3,500 of these teams scattered across facilities at Kaiser. And they took a beating during COVID because they just couldn't meet. And the staffing shortages have caused problems. So they're in the process of rejuvenating these committees or these unit-based teams. But I've seen them in action. I've studied them. I've participated in some. I've watched them. They're the real thing. And the energy that the docs get from being part of that, when they see what these teams can do, builds their support for the partnership. Where it wasn't there in the abstract. Doctors don't like to share authority and power. As we know, they think they're the king of the hill.
Well, so then what you're telling us then, the model of labor management is not just negotiating on contracts and representing employees' wages, but it's actually the welfare of the organization. It's a more holistic approach that looks at the entire picture. And that during negotiations and contracts, I'm sure everybody then is opening up the books. Yeah.
Well,
how is the organization doing?
Yeah, that's the way it should work. And that's the way it has worked at Kaiser. Now they're facing some challenges because they brought in some executives who are not as deeply committed to this partnership, but they'll work their way through that, is my guess. There's some bumps in the road, but we've seen that before. We've studied and worked with them over 20 years of partnership, and they had some big bumps in the road in those 20 years, like any organization. And as management succession takes place, and as new union leaders come in, so you've got to manage those things.
Has to be a commitment on both sides to a constructive win-win arrangement here where both parties add value and contribute. That seems to be kind of a summary here. But what about the other role, not but or and? It would seem to me, and this is something that I experienced, I've been in unions in an earlier lifetime, and I remember that I got my benefits from the union. I didn't get my benefits from the company. Aren't there also possibilities for unions to add value? You know, a lot of companies today are talking about outsourcing HR, you know, or a lot of it, or they already do. I would think that unions could actually play a role there because they can offer scale. If I'm a railroad union, I might have 10 different railroads. I might be able, is there a role not only in labor management, but also in human resources management or other ways to create value?
Well, that Bruce, I'm glad you raised that because I think this is a frontier issue, and I'll pick three issues where I think there's tremendous potential for unions to play a broader role and maybe to take more responsibility for a lot of HR functions. And the first one is training and development. We all know about apprenticeship programs, and they are the best training programs in the country in the sense of preparing workers for entry level and then making sure that workers stay current in their capacities as technology changes, as more electronics and other innovations come along. They have to continuously upgrade and they have industry standards. so that if you are in an apprenticeship program, whether it's with the electricians or the machinists or someone else, they have mechanisms for going back and retraining as time goes on, and they're on the front lines of training. For example, I visited the premier training program for the Carpenters Union, happens to be outside of or out in Las Vegas. And what do you see at this wonderful training program, training center? You see them teaching leadership as a tool, as something that young and growing roles for union stewards and business agents. The same kind of leadership that we teach MBAs at Sloan and other business schools, state of the art. But then there's also training on the technical side. But what they have is they have vendors coming in, showing them, well, here's some of the new materials. Here are some of the new techniques we're trying out. How would this work? How would you train your colleagues when you go back? And by the way, how does this work when you actually do it? Can you give the vendors some feedback? State-of-the-art training facilities like that, that really prepare the workforce to the future and inform the vendors, like everyone from, we saw 3M there, we saw Lincoln Electric there, we saw a number of others that build infrastructure and new scaffolding operations and very innovative virtual reality testing and so on. That's the kind of one thing that unions do and could do more of.
You there said two others.
There are joint training funds. And so the second area, I think, is on healthcare. There are healthcare programs, and some unions have their own healthcare funds, particularly in the craft unions again, but even in areas like hospitality. There are some union healthcare funds that cut across employers because there's economies of scale, and these hospitality workers move across jobs. A third is in the area of bringing people in. You hear about onboarding, and we have a whole series of HR vendors out there now who will provide staffing. Well, what if the union did a lot of training and onboarding and development, and sometimes English as a second language or as a new language for immigrants, and play that kind of role and help to supply your company and other companies in the industry with the kind of quality employees, and then supported them in terms of their life needs, and really made sure that they could stay with the employer because they may have some family obligations, and they may have some personal needs, and they may have some immigration issues. All of those services are services that unions of today and tomorrow could expand on.
Boy, do I love this. Larry, this really brings to, we're going to come a little out of left field to end this program up. It would seem to me, have you ever heard of a union, Larry, that didn't go to the employees, that went to management? And it says to management, we can do this better than you. We can actually help you reduce costs, improve efficiency, get more out of your worker voice because they're going to feel trusted to talk with us. Have you ever seen either of you gentlemen, I'll let you start, Larry, and I'm going to follow up with a second, even more intriguing question, I hope. Have you ever seen a union try to actually go to management and say, I can do a better job of this than you?
I'll defer to Tom on that. He has much more expertise on that issue.
But I'm sure the answer is no. But go ahead, Don.
Well, it's,
I think there are tricky political issues in doing so, but we'll hold those aside. Yeah.
Yeah, it's happening right now. And this isn't talking out of school, but it's happening in the electric vehicle battery industry, where there's going to be a need for for workers who are current auto workers transitioning into producing electric vehicles. And it's already happening, obviously, at some scale, but that scale is going to increase. And there will be some displacement, considerable displacement, because the people who now are on what we call the drivetrain, engines and transmissions, those jobs are labor intensive and a lot of them will go away. Not all of them, but a lot of them will go away. And the new jobs require new kinds of skills, both in the supply chain for building batteries and then for installing, maintaining them, servicing them. And so you see that the auto workers and some other unions are already talking and demonstrating what they could do to some of the battery manufacturers and others. And they're doing that partly in cooperation with the federal government, because the federal government is investing big dollars in promotion of these renewable energies, including batteries and electric vehicles. And so there's a national interest in doing this, because otherwise we need a fair adjustment policy for those people who will have to transition from existing jobs as we do more renewable energy and we do more electronic automobile production. And we want them to be able to take these new jobs and to have the skills needed. So we're seeing some of that happen, and there's conversations with employers about how to do this. Now, as Larry was suggesting, you have to be careful about the legal constraints. I mean, we have such an outmoded labor law that I tell most of my my friends to not worry about if you're doing the right thing, just go ahead and do it, because it's so outmoded. We need more experimentation like this, where there are enterprise or industry level agreements to work together on these issues, so that we have the workforce that we need, and so that these are good, high quality jobs, and that you start by demonstrating the value added from a union.
Well, yeah, because the scale. I mean, I live in the New York area, which is still very heavily unionized, and you can't drive 20 miles in any direction where there's not a union training session building. You know, right near there's a big Teamsters training operation near me. Larry, another zinger question that I'll let you take first. It would seem to me that there is so much waste built into so many companies with poor people management. And back in the 90s, as both of you know, there were a lot of raiders that were saying, there's tremendous waste here and we're going to go in and we're going to clean it up. Well, we know what they ended up doing. Yeah, they cleaned up short-term waste and created long-term consequences, right? So sustainable investors want long-term solutions. What about the argument, gentlemen, that a union actually goes to shareholders in when they're organizing and says to the shareholders, don't you folks realize that there is enormous waste built into this company because they treat workers like cogs in the wheel, even wonderful Starbucks. The reason people unionize is that the schedules are brutal and disrespectful of their life. At least that's what I've heard. I don't know that to be true. But my point is that isn't there really so much waste in management of people today that unions can make an argument that they can actually maybe improve things? A little bit, you know, far-fetched, Larry?
No, I don't think it's far-fetched. I mean, in many ways, the workers are the eyes and ears of the enterprise. They're the ones executing it. They see what goes on day to day, and people up at the higher levels may not see it or get to it. All right. So the question is, what are the mechanisms or means by which and incentives the workers have to share that understanding, contribute, and what have you? All right. The union as an institution, if you do things right, can be that modality to afford that critique. Whether and how you engage shareholders, that's an interesting question. Of course, you have a lot of shareholder activism, although that tends to be not focused on those kinds of issues.
Ironically, pension funds are the biggest pension funds are owned by labor. And by the way, a bunch of them have gotten together with Human Capital Management. You might know them, Tom, because they're in Detroit, or I guess they're somewhere. Both of you know them quite well. So it seems to me that unions really could play a bigger role in the mismanagement in this country today of people. Tom, I'm going to let you have the last word on that, is pretty comparable to the mismanagement of manufacturing in the last century. We built high levels of defects into our manufacturing. It was cheaper just to let the defects pile up than it was to have, you know, TQM, to, you know, and then the Japanese, of course, taught us a little bit of lesson that we've never regained. We've never regained the market share that they've taken from us. So my question, you know, sort of, Tom, you know, I like to look at unions as an opportunity for value creation. Is there an argument to made to shareholders that when a union is organizing that, hey, folks, you're paying a high price for mismanagement?
Well, that's right. And one way you can do that is to have conduits for information sharing from the bottom up to the top of the organization. I've sat on two different companies' boards of directors over the years, trucking companies, as an employee representative. And the value of doing that, of being at the board level, is not so much that you're going to have enormous influence as one or two people on a board, but what you do is you build trust with your peers on the board. You don't go in there demanding and bargaining. That's not the way. You recognize it is a peer relationship and it's a culture, and you have to build trust. But then you can raise the idea of, gee, why don't we broaden out our agenda instead of just hearing about financial returns every quarter when we meet or whenever we meet? Why don't we have an annual report or a quarterly report or a biannual report on the workforce, on safety and health, on turnover rates, on comparison of compensation increases at the bottom right up to the top of the organization? How fair are we in allocating our resources? And are we favoring one group at the top and not the others? What issues am I hearing? What feedback do I bring from the rank and file up to the board and say, these are some of the issues that are on the minds of the workforce, and we need to at least recognize it and discuss it and see if there are some things that need to be done from a strategic management standpoint. Now, the countervailing argument to me that I've heard is, well, I'm the CHRO, I'm the chief human resource. We are the channel. We can bring those voices. Well, that's just baloney. HR is not trusted in today's world. There's all kinds of evidence of that. And what the value of having an independent voice to, you know, sometimes speak truth to power, but by and large to say, look, I'm bringing you some ideas and I can show you that I've got the trust of the workforce because they can replace me anytime they want. That way, I've got to bring their ideas, but I got to bring it in a constructive way and say, well, we might not be able to do all of this, but you know, we got a real problem here in scheduling. And I hear it, I see it in the data. Why don't we have a report at the next quarterly meeting on our scheduling algorithms and how they work and how the workforce is receiving them? That kind of suggestion at the board level to other board colleagues often makes sense. And then the CEO goes off and tells the HR people, this is what we want to see at the next meeting. And you get results. But you can't just rely on management to take the initiative to do that, because they don't get the real information from the workforce.
You know, I love what you just said there, and that's a headline to me, Tom. Workers can't fire management, but they can fire the union. So that means that they will have more trust in that union, and they're going to speak more. Larry, that gets to your point, isn't it? That if in a proper labor management relationship where everybody's pulling on the same oars, right? Because again, if the pie gets bigger and workers share in it, everyone's going to be happy, right? So isn't that, Larry, the big role that a union can play in terms of establishing voice? The union is probably ideally the best vehicle for voice, because the union could be fired and management can't, and because the man and the union will not retaliate against things that it doesn't like in most cases. That seems to me a big value add for unions, isn't it? Worker voice.
Well, I mean, by definition, they are worker voice. They're representatives of the
If I may interrupt you on this, is because the trouble is a management often use worker voices just about salary. salary and working conditions. That's all it is, right? Well, what if we also put employees on the profit side and said, okay, yeah, you have to have a good working conditions, but we want you to be engaged in this organization. We're going to gain sharing efforts. And this time we're going to have well-organized, I love that, these four committees, these four goals. That seems to me to be a strong argument that union, that to make the shareholders, that unions can add value. They are not necessarily of sunk cost.
Well, no, I think Tom's, in his description of some of the work that he's done has clearly described that or illustrated that. Again, I think the question is one of having the union leadership to take the initiative to pursue that and to bring their membership along. But sometimes the membership may be short-sighted. They may not see it. So I think it goes back to the issue of both the vision and the leadership on the union side to understand that they can make that case for the union in terms of the role that it as an intermediary and the workers as such can contribute to the enterprise.
Well, and to just build on that, Larry, when I said there's a thin bench strength on the management side in dealing with an organized workforce, we're finding the same problem on the union side, that what you have is a large number of relatively older white men in union leadership positions, and you've got this young workforce in one company that we've been talking with. The HR, the labor relations representative, vice president said to me, when the last time we negotiated a contract compared to now, there's about 25% of our workforce that's never experienced a union contract. And they have no idea what to expect. And you have union leaders who have a hard time relating to the expectations, the broader expectations that young workers have, yes, for wages and fair wages, that's no different than any other time, but also as you mentioned, Bruce, for scheduling, for work-life balance, for hours of work, for a voice on issues around new technology, for a voice on climate change and other things. What does this company really stand for? Those are the issues that young workers care about today, and we've got to bring the leadership of unions as well as companies along to be able to relate to these, to give more voice to young workers and leadership responsibilities and opportunities, and to deal with them effectively, because that's a challenge for unions as it is for companies.
So the reset really has to happen on both sides of the table, in a sense. On the management side, to recognize that a constructive union relationship can actually add value. And if you look for value, and with a union that has that same mentality, you're saying, Tom, there's good evidence that a productive union relationship can actually be profitable for an organization over the long run, if there's labor management cooperation. That's right. And so, but both sides, it seems the lesson needs to be the reset. How do we get to that reset button? That's another story we're not going to have time to cover today. But I do. But in summary, it seems to me today that what we have learned is that there is definitively a model for constructive labor management, that it requires a change of mentality on both sides, that if there's a clear purpose of the organization that is clearly stated, and you have management that's receptive to worker voice, and you have men, and you have unions that are receptive, that are respectful of the purpose of the organization and its goals, that there really is a bright future for unions in the future. That seems to be my takeaway from today's program. And I thank both of you for participating in it today. Tom and Larry, thanks again.
Thank you, Bruce. Pleasure. Really enjoyed it.